Hello, this is Real History with Melissa, and today is the 30th of May, 2024, and I am joined today by Monica from Northern Ontario. Hello, Monica.
Hello, Melissa.
How are you? Are you hanging in?
I'm hanging in, as we discussed. Alan would always say, I'm hanging in.
Good.
And what did you say? That was really good, but not
hanging. I said, but not hanging that. Not hanging yourself. Sometimes Alan would
That's
say,
right.
I hope you're hanging in, but yes. Not hanging yourselves.
Yes, I do recall him saying that a couple of times. I do recall that, yes. That was, I do have to say that Alan had I loved his sense of humor because, you know, he made the I don't even know how he was able to do what he did with his ability to take basically a plan that was, I mean, the plan, we know the plan, and he was able to relay it to us in almost a lullaby fashion. And not in a way where you'd fall back asleep like what they're doing, but kind of like, you're able to get lulled into this bad information and not feel, and kind of be able to chuckle about it. Because you know when he would do his, it made me laugh. It made me laugh and it relieved so many things in me because, you know, when you're an island, when you feel like an island of bad news,
mm-hmm.
It's so releasing to laugh. You
yes.
know, when we spoke last, our very first conversation, which I just want to say that was just, I'm so grateful again. But when we spoke, I will tell you that I was just telling my mom this because I was telling her that I spoke with you and she corrected me on a few things, so I'll get to that. But what I said to her is, after speaking with someone that I can actually speak freely to, someone where I don't have to monitor what I say, how I say it. If I, you know, I would get emotional with you or I'd get excited and I'd get upset. These emotions and the range of emotions are, I don't know, somehow have been, I don't know if they've been somehow, I don't know if it's nulled or I kind of feel like maybe some sort of program hasn't been put in some people. You're not allowed to have these emotions because you're aggressive.
Okay.
So when I got off the phone with, yeah.
I want to come back to that. I want to let you finish the story, but let's not
yes.
forget to come back to the full range of emotions.
Yes. So, thank you. That's
all right.
A great. And you know what? If you're good at that, I'm very good. I'm very good at forgetting, but if you're good at remembering, but well, I'll depend on partly on you to bring us back to that.
Okay.
But, yeah. And so when I got off the phone with you, it must have been, I don't know what time it was. It was well after 12, I think. I couldn't get to sleep because I was so elated. I was able to speak to someone about, and you understood my jokes when I made, you know, jokes that I thought were funny, that Alan thought was funny, you thought was funny. And I very rarely have, like, when I'll make a sarcastic remark about something that I think is super funny, something that I think he would have appreciated, I generally get blank stares because most people aren't on the same page. So then I kind of come off like I'm laughing to my own jokes, but I'm trying to connect with these people. And that night, 12:30, and I had an 8-hour day of work, and I mean physical work, like what you and Alan used to do with snow. And you know, when you live up there, you literally learn how to, you re-educate yourself through your labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone 8 hours. It was 8 hours. We had just we literally had just finished taking a bath because I was just getting out of bath. It was 9:30 or something. After I got off the phone with you, the energy that sustained me. It sustained me up until probably yesterday because I was so, it's true. Melissa, I live in Canada and Canada is probably one of the most sleepiest countries, if not the sleepiest countries. Cause I mean, even England is fighting back at this point for heaven's sake.
Mm-hmm.
But Canada, the one thing I was super proud of Canadians was that they were politely protesting on the convoy.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that, you know, that one act was something extraordinary when it comes to Canadians, but they were able to extinguish it so quickly that now I think nobody's going to do a convoy here in Canada. That's my personal belief.
Well, Monica,
I think that was a real lesson,
and I think it was meant to be a lesson globally for people, because
yes.
Trudeau went after people's bank accounts. I mean,
women that had, like single mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Like there are stories of single mothers that were not able to pay their rent because he froze a $50 contribution.
Yes.
Now, I thankfully, when I did it, I contributed, and I contributed before he put out his tyrannical rant and said that he's going to be freezing. So I did it right before, like I'm talking 24, 36 hours. I would have had my business completely frozen. My business would have been completely frozen, because I believe that we have a right in any country, in every country, to the sovereignty of our body.
Right.
Because if a country can be sovereign, allegedly, then your body is the very first, like the family is the beginnings of a tribe, your body is the first fundamental island.
So, Monica, am I hearing you right? You don't believe that you're a slave?
Oh, I believe that I am enslaved without permission.
Yes.
Against my will.
Yes.
Against my will, I am a slave, because how do you survive outside the system unless you are like, and I think his name was, what was his name? Mike? Michael?
Matt.
He was
yes.
also from Poland.
Yes.
Matt.
Yes.
Is it Matt?
Yes, Matt.
Matt from
Poland.
Well,
his name is actually something that is unpronounceable unless you're from Poland, but.
It's probably my coach.
Say yes, yeah.
How?
Yeah. It's got a C in it and a Z, and you're like, what?
My husband always says, "You Polacks, you sound like you're crushing ice in your mouth," because we have such harsh. It's a fairly harsh language.
Well, before a harsh language, I'm sorry I just interrupted you, but this is,
I
noticed when we talked, Monica, that this is what we did. We just had this excitement that was blah. So,
I was thinking about that. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Well, what I wanted to say is that you were about to tell the story of talking to me and then talking to your mother, but I wanted to back up. Is it okay for me to supply a little bit of
yes.
biographical information about you? Is that okay?
Please.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Monica, her family is from Poland. Her parents came over to Canada from Poland in 1981. There was actually a layover someplace for a year, one of those refugee places. Where was that?
That's right, Italy.
It was Italy. Okay.
Yeah. And I think we were in Rome for first 3 months until they got us established, and then we went to Capua, which was a big camp where it's basically a refugee camp, except it's not the refugee camps that we see images of on the mainstream media. A lot of camps don't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of camps are basically an enclosed community behind, like, a gated community, and they have, like, apartment buildings if they have the infrastructure. And in those days where people were running away from communist and socialist countries, which is what my mom corrected me, because she said Poland never fully became communist because of the resistance, so it was socialist.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't realize that. I thought it was communist full on, but I was incorrect, according to my mom, and she knows history, you know, very, very well, because she was raised in a socialist, non-communist country that I thought we were in.
Well, okay, so
that's bliss when you don't know. Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting point that you make about the camps, because I think there's a difference too. This is back in the very, very early 80s, and what you had at that time was a managed, tightly controlled refugee immigrant system for all countries across yes. Europe and North America, where countries only took in really what they could handle. What you described as an interim period, many people that I've talked to in that era also had the same thing, where they were in an interim refugee establishment that sounded very orderly, enclosed, community-like, as opposed to what we have now, which is the agenda
That's
is
right.
to flood all countries with way more yes. refugees and migrants than they can handle. So, you know, but anyway, so you came over to Canada when you were 8, and you have been married more than 30 years, I'll leave it at that, to a Portuguese
yes.
gentleman,
yes.
a Portuguese husband.
That's right.
And he came from, he's Portuguese, but he's an island, Portuguese
yes.
islander from San Miguel. Now, I just have to say exactly. this because it's astonishing. He had, his mother and father were married to each other forever, and he
yes.
has 19 brothers and sisters.
Brothers and sisters. All of them, actually, so he's got 18 brothers and sisters, but 19 of them all together. So just
okay.
a small
okay.
correction, but there's 19 of them all together. Yes.
Uh-huh.
One mother, one father. And it's interesting. That was very interesting because we have very different, upbringings. I grew up in a very controlled environment where you weren't allowed to say anything, but I never felt like I was poor, where I didn't have shoes or I didn't have, you know, something to eat. Whereas he didn't ever grow up in a constraint or confinement in terms of social or emotional or anything. He was like wild. They were wild, but they were immensely poor, immensely poor. Like that, from what I understand from the stories, and there might be some, obviously, maybe there may be some misaligned stories, but from the stories I remember, like the first few kids only had shoes for Sunday for church. Otherwise, they ran around with no shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
70s, 80s. So he learned something different than I learned. He learned scarcity, and I learned the control mechanism that is more sinister, right? He's got this, I don't know, he's got this ability to not be afraid of anything, because he wasn't afraid of anything. Like, they had to go in other people's backyards and see if they can steal, like, a pear or an apple, or because they were poor. There was so many of them. But me, I was scared to say the wrong thing, because I was just telling my mom, I remember being one way at home and having to be a different way outside. And I remember getting in trouble because I would do things from my indoor sort of behavior
mm-hmm.
as opposed to out the world behavior. And he never learned that. So I learned how to manage my thoughts and manage sort of that you have to be careful what you say, whereas he never learned that. They say anything at any time, and they're not afraid of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But they compensate in different ways because now poverty is like kind of a fear for them. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't know if
now
that's,
I have
that's
some.
A
I have a,
thing to say.
I have a few. Well, at least a couple of questions here. Now, the first is the poverty that your husband experienced in his family. Yes, it was an incredibly large family, and they had to go steal an apple or a pear from the neighbors. But was it? Were they just an isolated case of poverty in San Miguel because they were a large family, or was that the norm amongst his?
From what I understand, because it's also, his family doesn't, like you and me are talking, and we're talking about past and history, and I want to know these things. I know a lot of things about his family that the second generation no longer knows. So I abnormally know more about his family and his life because I was interested. I wanted to know, kind of like when you do real history, you're learning about real history of real humans, not some guy on a horse that had millions of dollars and ran a country and supposedly this was his story. But I'm interested in these things, like yourself. I feel I get smarter by learning what people's life experiences were. Whether I agree with them or not, they're still interesting. I don't know if most people are interested. I did that with my grandma. I did that with my husband, with his family. But my feeling is that in general, San Miguel and all of those little islands that belonged to Portugal were quite poor generally. But, for example, my husband's grandfather, it's been said in the family, and how much is, you know, elaborating, making things bigger, the fish is two times bigger than it was when you caught it. I don't know how much of that there is. The grandfather was quite well off, and I want to say almost on the verge of wealth, but because the son, my husband's dad, decided to go with a woman that had no education, had no schooling, or education schooling, she also came from an impoverished family, the father said, if you want to be with this woman, you are no longer welcome in this family. Well, as it were, he chose to be with the woman, and they were impoverished, and the grandfather never, ever looked at them again. So he missed out on 19 grandchildren, and that would make me believe that perhaps there isn't a lot of conflation or making it bigger, but he maybe was a wealthier man and understood that once you, as the elites know, once you go into a situation where you have education and money and you go into non-education, non-money, and there isn't like a situation where, you know, this woman is extremely bright, out of the ordinary, she just needs a little bit of a leg up. No, it wasn't that situation, and the father realized that and was trying to sort of organize his son's, I guess, life. His son wouldn't have any of that, and so they were just kind of cut out from the family. So do I know if they would have been better off if he had chosen a different woman? Perhaps. But it kind of shows about how life is. Money separates people. Money makes things easier, but it actually complicates life in ways that I don't think, realize. Because if we didn't have the money, which will never happen because this whole system is predicated on money, on this thing that doesn't really even exist, people just... I guess he wanted to keep his wealth, right? And he discarded a child because now, of the choices that child made.
This is interesting.
But that happens in other rich, yeah. Well, in other wealthy families.
It makes me want to ask a question, which you probably wouldn't know because he cut the son off. But it certainly sounds like Freemasonic thinking.
That's what I mean. And I said that to my husband. I said, listen, if we had lots of money and we were in big circles and these circles had money as well, you can't just allow your child to do that because that's disrespect. And even though they have devalued our children and debauched our society, their society in which they function has very clear and concise rules that nobody breaks. Mm-hmm. And when they do break, well, they know the consequences. Mm-hmm. Whereas what they've taught us is go with your emotion, be a victim, cry, get upset. Whereas there's this really good show that I didn't watch because I don't watch really any shows anymore, but my daughter was watching the show and someone else told me about it, but it was called The Blacklist. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It had like 400 series, so I'm like, oh, I just don't have time to be. If I get involved in one of those things, I can get addicted to TV, so I try to avoid it altogether. I don't have any cable. I have a Netflix account, and it's all starting to get so crazy where I can't even watch a movie anymore just for even an entertainment like I used to. Like in terms of entertainment, looking for information, that's the only way I watch movies. But they teach us one thing, and we keep getting worse and worse, but they stick to their absolute truth. So respect of the parent, respect of the family, working together as a whole, being a tribe. These are things that if you do not have these traits, you're kicked out of the Masonic order. If you don't follow the rules, you get kicked out. And that's on a good day. On a bad day, you get to meet your maker. Yes. But what do they teach us? Stay in the emotion. Get pissed off. Oh, excuse my language. Get mad. Fight back.
Right.
Get appalled. You know, all of the emotions that make us dizzy.
Right.
All of the emotions that don't like us, make us focus and concentrate. This movie, or this, I think it's a series. It's a series because it's called The Blacklist, and it's got like, I think, 11 or 12 seasons. Ridiculous. But almost in every, episode, there was major truths that were being told. Major truths. And the main character is a psychopath, is an elite, and he shows you exactly how they operate. Mm-hmm. And not once, even if faced with death, is he ever emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at them, they don't seem very emotional.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things there that you bring up in that series. One thing that Alan has said about the way that the higher orders or the higher degrees of Freemasonry work is there's a few things. First of all, a young person, even just coming into Freemasonry, in other words, you know, maybe being given a leg up, so to speak.
Yes.
He'll come in and now...
Yes.
Word to the wise is kind of a Freemasonic term there. Word to the wise. And listen, when you're given a word to the wise, if you want to be wise, you best be taking that advice. So one of the things mm-hmm. that they might do in giving you a leg up is to say, oh, you know, hey, look at so-and-so's daughter over there. She'd be good for you. Well, if you're wise, you just go get so-and-so's daughter and you make her yours, and that's your family right there. That's word to the wise.
Yeah.
You don't get up in the higher degrees of Freemasonry until I think the second generation can get a little bit further, but it's the third generation of
That's right.
what you might call the selective breeding within Freemasonry, then that's where you can go to the higher degrees. And that's what you have.
Yes, and I didn't... Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I didn't know that until a couple of shows ago you had... I don't know if it was you or someone that you were speaking with had said that. I didn't realize that you had to wait three generations to... And that makes sense, though, because... If you can't really climb and be trusted in the first generation,
mm-hmm.
that makes sense to me. Because mm-hmm. if I was a business person, I wouldn't let just anyone in because, I mean, so when you get married in out of your culture, so me and my husband, you know, we look the same, but we are so not the same. We did not grow up at all in any world the same. He grew up without shoes, stealing and being shot at because he was going and trying to steal some food. And I grew up in a completely different way. And when you meet people, you really don't know them. I've been with my husband over 30 years, and he still surprises me when he says something or does something. The fact that he came on board and started, I was with him, oh, I would say close to 20 years, and he'd be like, oh, my God, could you, like... Why do you have to listen to all this stuff? And I'm like, because it is interesting. Don't you agree that some of this is like, yeah, but why? You're just going to stress yourself out, right? So you don't really, you don't really know someone. Even if you are with them all the time, they can surprise you because you don't know them. If I was a business person, I would do exactly the same thing. I wouldn't trust the first generation.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make sure that they really, really do the work. The second generation also could be still tainted. It actually makes sense why they wait three generations
mm-hmm.
to do anything with them because they completely don't remember anything of the old, as it were. Because now they've had three generations of, well, what would it be? Would it be brainwashing or I don't know. I don't even know how people are able to agree to join this. I really don't understand it.
Because the money system, it's dog eat dog, and
yes.
everybody understands they may not even take it as far in their thinking as you did, where money complicates things or separates people or whatever. It's just clear in this system that we're born into that if you have money, things are easier. That's as simple as
yes.
that.
And that is true. It is true because utility, it is easier to be able to go and buy something outright. But it that's the only, I think that's the only thing it really helps them. Because everything else long-term, money completely rots. Like money outside of being able to go and buy, like say, new equipment, right? Let's just say your equipment is not, you know, it's not really great, that great anymore, whatever, and you have the money. Okay, well, you don't have to stress about it. You don't have to work harder to get it. But when you do have to work harder for something, you also become more creative. You expand yourself. You have a challenge. So when you have money, it makes you a little more lackadaisical. You're not worried as much because you have this false sense of security because you think that because you have money, you can fix anything. But really what it does is it makes you lackadaisical. It makes you lazy because you think you can just buy everything. And you can, but then it leaves you empty because you don't realize you're empty until you get to the point where you're empty. But you're honest, I honestly feel that money long term, outside of just being able to quickly fix something like replacing a part or going and getting something, everything else is long term, it hurts because it hurts our family. I feel like money, if you're in the money, you have one set of problems. If you're out of money, you have another set of problems. But ultimately, it's just a utilitarian because, look, all of us have more money. We all had more money. We all had more money in 2020. Everybody was getting free money. Well, not everybody, but many people. It didn't make them better people.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There's a couple of things that, that's okay, Monica. There are just two things that you made me think of that when we talk about money and how it affects people, I think we need to distinguish. We have to think about, Alan was saying that quote, you know, it came from Bertrand Russell, but there were others who said, you know, we're creating through eugenics, through breeding programs, through diet, injection, and injunction. We're through and education. Injection. Through our indoctrination that occurs in education, they're getting two different indoctrination. They're getting two different forms.
It's more true.
Yes, but what I'm saying here is that when we talk about money, we need to talk about how money affects the say the ruling elite or those that are higher up in the Masonic orders, and how it affects everybody else. Yes. Because people who are higher up in these orders and in the ruling class, if you will, they understand too the downside and the dangers of money. But if we want to look at this from a spiritual, the very highest level that maybe we can get to right now, is that we're perhaps, are we not, in a battle between creator and anti-creator. So we're looking at a group of people who don't really care about creativity because they can steal or buy what they need. Yes. That's on the one hand.
That's right.
But further on to that, you have got the way that the families have always run there. Let's just look at the English system of inheritance. Who gets the title and the land and the castle or the abbey or whatever? It's the firstborn son. What happens to the other sons? They have to join the military. They have to become priests, whatever. You know, in other words, everything goes on to that firstborn son. Therefore, your educational hopes, and in other words, they don't, even amongst the elite, they don't have to worry that much about the inculcation of values spreading out throughout the entire family, as long as they've secured that the one, allegiance of the one son.
Yes.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. And to that point, as you were talking, I just thought as well, to build on that, when people buy and steal because they have money, they essentially, and that's what it was, I have sometimes a hard time explaining, sometimes, you know, when you have something in your brain and then you're trying to explain it and then you're like, that didn't exactly sound right, like what I meant, but to add to what you were saying, if they are able to steal and they're able to buy everything that they need, that is them. They're powerful because they have the money. But someone like you, for example, I was thinking of you, and I'm trying to sort of try to, I'm trying to formulate the sentences in order to make this clear, because I know that I, you are such a good speaker, so I just, it just makes me nervous.
But don't be nervous,
for example,
Monica.
Yeah. But you're a wonderful speaker. That's why I'm trying to formulate a sentence that makes sense. But what I meant was, when they buy and steal things that they didn't create, because they have the money, they have the power, they are still, and they must know that they are still weaker than someone like you, that you didn't have to steal, you didn't have to buy, you created out of thin air. And that's the strength of human. That's the strength of our spirit and our soul, because we can be powerful without this thing called money that they've got us hooked on. And it's the same like food and entertainment. They hooked us on, I think we were talking about how human beings just innately have these things, they get addicted to things, but it's a double-edged sword, because you need to learn, your body needs to learn what it likes, it needs to know what's good. So on the one hand, it needs it, but they're using our own nature against us. So the addiction, they pulled out the addiction, they've hooked us into believing that this money will able to sustain our addictions, whether it's food. I mean, we can see that addiction is very much in the food department. And right now in Canada and in the States, I mean, I've looked at videos, they're horrific, and I've seen them in real life, like people bent over weirdly. I guess they're taking those drugs that they're bent over and they stand there for hours. These people believe that money is their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or that not having, you know, buying something is a problem, or not getting something for their children or for themselves. But it's not. They've forgotten to create. They've
yes.
forgotten that they are the magic. They
yes.
are the magic.
Well,
but they believed that money was the magic.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they've bought the illusion, and you know, I put up
yes.
on just yesterday, because we're recording this on Monday, the 27th. I put up as a redux a talk that Ellen had with Jackie Petru in probably 1998, and the audio quality was very poor, and people were saying, can I see a transcript? I couldn't understand it. And I said, well, you know, that was one that just happens to be available for sale in disc form only. But for people who had a hard time listening to that one, I suggest that you put on a pair of headphones, a headset, and listen to it that way. It's such a good talk. Also know that I ran that audio through a filter for Sunday.
Wow.
And the quality of audio that I achieved by doing that was so much higher than what's available for sale on a disc. It makes me think, if I had time, I'd run them all through a filter and
yeah.
make a better sound and, you know, note to self, something to do. But what I wanted to say there is that he's having a back and forth with Jackie Petru, which wasn't really meant for radio initially. It's just the two of them talking on the phone. And
yes,
I
remember her.
Yes, he keeps saying, we're born into an illusion. Everyone has to think themselves out of the illusion for themselves. And she kept returning to the money problem and saying, well, we all have to pay our property taxes or we lose our house. And he said, you must think your way. He said, if enough people could think themselves into being individuals, could think themselves out of this, the money system would collapse all by itself.
Completely now, disappear. It wouldn't be needed.
No, so I'm going to let you talk again in a second, but I just reminded myself of the emotions that we were going to talk about at the beginning of the conversation. I remembered the point that I wanted
yes.
to make.
And I love that, because it's true.
In a talk that
it's true.
Put up not long ago, Alan was talking about the quest in this life. What are we here for? What is our purpose? And Alan said in one talk that people get the idea of the Trinity has become confused. And I must add in there, as he did, deliberately confused.
Yes.
And he said
yes.
the soul, your soul quests to unite with your spirit. And at one point when he's explaining this, he said, I believe that personality comes, maybe only is coming into effect when that has been achieved. Real personality. Wow. So if you think about real personality, what do you have? You have real, genuine emotions that are human, because obviously we don't want to be manipulated emotionally. This is what entertainment does, and it does so well. But emotions are part of what make us human. And so when when you're talking about dealing with people out in the public and you say something or you make a joke and they don't get it and you're talking about the emotions and everything, I think that what we're seeing, because I've pondered this, is we're seeing the flatness of people who are only existing. They're not living. They're only existing within the illusion, and everything that they have tried to grasp hold of or make or shape, and this cuts across the board socioeconomically, everything that they grasp a hold of, it's not true. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not real.
Yes. No. But there's so many things in this system that have been touted to be true, and they're not even real. And
correct.
We start with base money. Mm-hmm. We start with base money. And I agree with you 100% what you just said. And you know what's really interesting, because I've been pondering this, because I think I told you that, and I did tell you, the one thing, when you and Johnny were talking about the shock, about, you know, how they were going to do it, what they were going to do, even though we listened and we knew that there was all these different ways that it can happen, or it can happen all, as Alan said, it can all happen all at once. They can do all of them because they know we won't be able to handle it because they know so much about us. I'm finding that the young people have been subverted, as our very brave Russian spy taught us. What was his name?
Bezmenov.
I loved that man. I loved his outfits, too. They were just so fashionable. I love watching him just for the outfit. But I'm joking. I'm being sarcastic. But I love his outfit. He was so very Russian. I love, because that, he, when I watch him, it feels like home, because we're very similar to Russians. But what I find with these young people is, we're being told to be emotionally aware, to know about the emotions, this, that, and the other thing. But what you said rung true for me. There's a flatness in the young people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a flatness, like as if they've lost spirit, life, spark. That black little screen feels like has sucked out the life out of these children. They have everything. Like my mom and I talk about this. They have everything. I remember I was 5 years old or 6 years old. I can't remember how old. I think I was 5 or 6. We had to walk up the hill. I mean, this is a first world problem technically still. But we had to walk up a huge mountain to go down one ski hill. And we would do it. And, you know, I'll never forget it because I lost my ski. One of my ski took off, and then I had to go in between my dad's legs to go down this big, huge mountain, because I used to live in the mountains where my family's from. It's sort of the mountain people. So I'm double messed up in Canada, because I'm like basically a Russian in Canada. Like, I'm pretty tough. I say things as they are. I've learned to not do that. I've gotten myself in a lot of trouble by speaking my opinion. But I will tell you that the people, the young people that are being pumped out by these universities they're emotionally charged in the sense that they get offended very quickly, but they have no spark. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go and, they want to have an adventure, but you know what they want to have an adventure for? The social media post. They don't actually want to jump off the cliff just to feel that energy, that spirit that goes, jumps in you with that adrenaline that, you know, when we used to go and jump off trees and do papa wheelies and things like that, like, they don't have that. They just want to do it for the social media post. Mm-hmm. And half the time they're not even experiencing the actual event because they're so worried about making sure that, you know, their mic is working and their camera's on the right angle and they've got the bongo and dongle or whatever they call them, whatever. That's what they're doing. They're doing a production. They're not doing experience of life.
I don't want to mock someone's death. I really don't, because people have had a number done on them, and it's so tragic. Everything that you're describing is a real tragedy. But there have also famously been they've covered deaths where the very last thing that you saw was someone filming with their little camera and their setup, bungee jumping off a cliff, or, you know, they're doing some extreme thing for social media. I mean, somebody famously just walked over a cliff and fell to their death as they were, you know, filming something for social media. And this is tragic. I don't mock it, but I am saying, you know, there's something else too in that talk that I just posted on Sunday. Alan was talking, this is 1998, and he's already telling you where it's going to go in terms of brain shipping and so forth. And he said right there to Jackie, what is that, 26 years ago now? He said, they have already got virtual reality, and this affects the brain. And frankly, I know 100%. That we're told that we have to wait for the 6G technology to have a proliferation of augmented reality, which is when something like, say, for instance, pops up out of your Apple Watch, because we all or your phone, because I mean, who's not just pining for Tinkerbell to come up out of your phone and dance around?
I can't wait to meet her myself.
It's just so ridiculous.
It really is ridiculous.
But I mean, this is what it's affecting people's brains. That's what I'm saying.
It is
very harmful.
Well, I will add to that, because since we're building on each other, I will tell you, I'm just stepping out, so if the wind gets too bad, I'd just like to be outside. I don't want to be inside anymore. So I apologize. If there's wind, just let me know and then I'll move. But I will do one up on you. I mean, not one up, add on to that, onto what you're doing, what you're saying. My granddaughter, so I have a granddaughter. She's under 2 years old. You should see. And she is a child. She's a child, like, of course, when you're a grandparent, it's completely different than when you're a parent, because you see things in more of a Tinkerbell kind of light. There's more magic to the child. They're just, you're not responsible for this child the way you were for your own children. And so you get this benefit of being able to love this child, but having to love her, not having to, you know, not having to be the, you know, the boss or the provider. You are just enjoying the actual fruits of having to love that child. She's not even two, and she knows, as soon as she sees a phone, she wants to go on that phone. And if you take that phone away, which is what always happens, because we're always hiding our phones, I do not want my child to be exposed to any screens. Unfortunately, that is not, I don't see eye to eye necessarily with my daughter about a lot of things, and especially when it comes to, you know, the things that I hold dear to me in terms of information. So, you know, that's difficult in a family. Mm-hmm. But if you see, speaking back on, I'm trying to get back to the affects the brain. I can take practically anything away from her if I say, look, I need this back, or no, can you please return it? That's not yours, or no, I'm sorry, you can't play with that. This child is so intelligent that she understands there's no problem. My daughter's doing a very good job of speaking to her and trying to get her to understand in a calm manner. But if you try to take that phone away, she loses her mind.
Wow.
She has a tantrum. And we just ignore it because we're not going to let her, you know, just because she has a tantrum. It's not good for you. You're not having it. But it actually alters the brain. And I've had words with my daughter not to expose her to any screen for the first 3 years. I am with that, you know, I haven't discussed it with my daughter, obviously, but now I see that it's altered my granddaughter already. So, yes, right. It's true. It affects them in a way where you and I can talk about it until we're green in the face, but we really don't know how sinister it really is.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you Alan knew how sinister it really was, because I didn't even realize how sinister it was. The Polish guy that you had that real history with?
Matt.
Mateusz.
Yes.
He inspired me because I've had so many health issues. I've never been overweight. I've never had a problem with weight. But he inspired me to finally look at a diet that I just never thought. I always thought it was for overweight people. So when you eat only animal products, you lose a lot of weight. And I was never interested in losing any weight because I'm a fairly thin person all my life, so I don't worry about those kind of things. But I've always had problems with IBS, eczema. Now all of a sudden, and Alan talked about it, and I'm like, yep, that's me right there. I all of a sudden developed a deathly allergic. Like if I get bit by a wasp again, I probably won't. Without my EpiPen, I will not have time to get to the hospital. Because it's so bad. Overnight, I've been bitten by wasps. I used to collect bees. I'm not allergic to bees. My grandmother used to collect bees, and she used to get me to collect bees for her, and she would get them to sting her for her arthritis. So I used to be stung by these things. I'm not a person that's scared to get stung by bugs and bitten by dogs. Like, I'm not scared of nature. But all of a sudden, I had overnight one bite, and it just killed me. Nearly killed me.
Okay, I have to just say, so I'm sorry to hear that, but I am getting wind feedback now.
Are you?
A few times. Okay. Yeah, just a few times. You know that.
I think it might be. Yeah, no. I don't want to mess up the audio because that's just going to be no bueno. But yeah, so I am moving into the downstairs location. Where it's nice and quiet. But that, and I'm sorry, I fell off my rails.
You were talking about the wasp and the bees and the getting stung, and I'm sorry I interrupted your train of thought.
No, it's totally fine. It's totally fine because I don't even remember why I was talking. Oh, food. So that when that started happening, everything started getting worse. I had IBS. I had problems with my bowels. I went to the doctor. I was asking, like, I tried to fast. I started looking at diets. I started fasting, and then I would only eat, like, in four-hour segments, bloating, and just overall, I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. So I was listening to The Real History with Mateusz, and I was listening to what he said, and he had said he didn't talk about weight, because I always thought this diet was for weight control.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about it because, you know, Jordan Peterson, I do listen to him every once in a while. I do believe that he has his little agenda, but I do think that he does say a few things that can make me think differently as well. And him and his daughter, I guess, are on this diet because of autoimmune diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about this diet 5 years ago, and then again I heard it through Matt. And the way that Matt represented that diet was that basically, no, this is all we eat because this is all we need to eat and this keeps us healthy. And I liked his resolve. I liked the fact that he was clear-minded. He knew what he wanted. He went for it. And he really is confident in what he's doing. And I thought he seemed like he really knew, you know, he really knew his stuff about this diet, and it just seemed, I don't know why he affected me, but I went and started looking at this diet. Shortly after, I think maybe a week or two, I went on the diet. And Melissa, ever since I went on this diet, I realized that I think I have a theory on how, because Alan never really talked about how did we get here? How is it that they were able to trick us so wholly and entirely? Like, they have us on every front. They have us financially. They have us with food. They have us with air. They have us with water or any kind of drink. Because, I mean, if you drink anything outside of water, it's poison. And if you drink the water from a tap, it's also poison. So where do you go?
Mm-hmm.
Right? The water was poisoned. The air is, I mean, what do you do? So I started this diet, and I've realized that food is probably one of the largest tools that they use to control us.
Mm-hmm.
Because ever since I started this diet, it's changed the way I see the world, the way I even am able to receive information. I'm much calmer. I'm able to digest things much better. Like, I don't get so anxious. I find that especially after the medical treatment that they rolled out as mandates, a lot of people are much more anxious. They're getting depressed. And I understand that the world is falling apart, and they're not really seeing that it's ungluing, but they're feeling it because our soul and our spirit feels it. Like, when my cousin was dying, there was something happening between us leading up to her death that I didn't realize was happening until she died. Because until you have time to be still and quiet, you can't think. And I know that the way that we're eating, when you're poisoned, like when someone's poisoning you, you can't think straight. Not because you can't think straight because you're not intelligent, but because you're poisoned. Like, I kind of bring it to, you know, when you're not feeling well, when you have a cold,
mm-hmm.
you can function, right? Ostensibly, you can function. You can still get up, make yourself a coffee or a tea, whatever you like. If you have children, you can, if you have a cold and it's just really bad, you maybe have a low-grade fever, but you can still get up and you can still, you know, feed the chickens. But you're not doing it happily. You're not doing it humming. You're not doing
right.
it with a lot of energy, right?
Right.
You're kind of like, you're fighting something, and your body's multitasking now because you're trying to live your life, which takes energy, and then now your body's inside fighting whatever it is, and you're not feeling well. I would say that this diet is like a low-grade cold for your entire life.
Mm.
And I realize that this diet is political. Because why are they going after our meat? It's the last frontier outside of our mind, because that's the first
mm-hmm.
frontier,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is, however that goes. Because, you know, English is kind of my second language, and sometimes I mix things up. So I'll say stupid things sometimes. But the thing is that when you are poisoned, your body is still fighting. You don't know that it's poisoned because you don't have flags coming out of your eyes or out of I don't know, something happened. We got disconnected.
Yeah, that was just strange. It was completely sudden, and there you go. So,
yeah,
but
I was like, hello?
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm glad I got you back. But you were talking about how you don't have stuff coming out of your eyes. And
yeah. No. So basically, I realized that the more I'm – so I've only been on the diet a little over – I'm going on 4 months now. It was almost right after you spoke with – it was very shortly after you spoke with Matt that I looked into this diet, because I thought, again – but now that I'm on it, my husband has gone on it, and even he says that you don't know what you don't know. And when you're poisoned all your life, you don't know what unpoisoned feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, the fact that they're going after meat, the fact that they're now injecting the meat with the same stuff that they tried to mandate us with, that really does speak volumes. And I always tell people, and I don't know, this is my working theory, this is only me talking about this food, because, like, what was it, food, what is it, injections,
diet,
and
yes,
what was it, how diet,
yes.
injunctions and injections.
Yeah, so that basically that means diet, what they shoot into you and what laws they put you under.
That's right. That's right. And I never really, and I always thought when he meant diet, and see, this is my working, this is not what Alan said, but this is, I'm working on what Alan had given me. And you know, I said to my mom, because I spoke with her for several hours today, I said to her, I go, you know, Mom, the way that Alan would speak is very much like reading the Bible. When you're reading the Bible, you're not supposed to, as far as I understand it, you're not supposed to take it word for word. You're supposed to take the lessons and apply it to today. So Alan would speak in not maybe riddles, but he spoke in ways where he didn't say the way I speak, because I tried to say it outwardly because I feel like, okay, you guys won't understand, so I'm going to say it. But he was wise because he knew that if he only gave enough, just enough for people to understand, but not so much to give it away to every Joe and, you know, Harry, because everybody's not going to want it. Only the people that are curious about what did he mean by that? And then they're going to look more, and then they're going to look more, because all my life I've been trying to wake people up. And now, after Alan has left us, I finally heard him. Just stop wasting your time. You're not going to wake them up anyway.
You know,
you can only talk to the people that are curious.
Monica, that's funny, because what you're talking about is straight out of the Bible. So they go somewhere. I'm a great paraphraser because I'm not a Bible scholar, but they go somewhere. Jesus talks to them.
Me neither, yeah.
The crowd. He talks to the crowd. They come back, the disciples. They go, hey, Jesus, how come you talk to us plainly? But when we're out with the masses, you speak in parables and kind of riddles, as it were. And Jesus said,
yes.
Because I'm afraid they might understand what I'm saying. Now, that's in the
right.
Bible. I have just paraphrased it grotesquely, and I can't tell you. It's basically what he said is that
the message,
it's
message
only
was very,
for
very
not. It's not for everybody. It isn't for everybody.
No.
It has never been for everybody. It's for people who have eyes to see and ears to hear, who are desperate to understand. They're desperate to know, and they will go on that journey, and they'll keep pursuing. They will search truth out. Now, I wanted to get back to diet though, really quickly, because it's funny because I haven't been strict with it for a little over a month now, and I do see some differences. One thing, though, that doing that, it really drove home to me, no sugar in any form except for fruit. And that's just me, because I'm not really a great I can't stay committed to a super rigid diet. I've never been able to do that in my whole life. It doesn't feel, for me,
and
natural.
Me neither.
Yeah. But so I've been wanting a lot of fruit.
So
I had said a couple of months ago, all I was eating for breakfast was bacon and eggs. Well, all I have had for breakfast for the last month is a bowl of chopped up fruit and some plain yogurt tossed around it, because that's what I've wanted.
Yeah.
And then I've had this craving for kimchi, which is fermented cabbage that the Koreans eat, and also sauerkraut. I'm having a craving for sauerkraut and kimchi and chopped up fresh tomatoes, which incidentally are also a fruit. So I've been eating, and I was raised a vegetarian, and at one point in my life when I was gone, I had left the house already. My parents got into veganism, and let me tell you, Monica, the moment that I snuck away from that, you know, that my friends are like, oh, let's go have a beer. Nah, I want a hamburger.
I want meat.
Yeah.
And you know what's really interesting, that you came out of, and that's another thing, veganism is another way to control us, because this is my opinion, and I also believe that there is, and I'm not as good as, like, Johnny is so good at like remembering date. I am terrible. I don't know if I can clump myself in your camp, or if I have a whole nother camp that I can create about, like, my camp is called Dory, you know, from Finding Nemo. I'm really good if I remember my name, and I always laugh that I've had placenta brain since the first child, and I've had three children, so I think they took my brains completely because my memory is non-existent. But what I will say is that I truly believe that veganism, I think Alan touched on this too, it actually strips your body, because what happens is plants are wonderful. I was basically almost a vegetarian because I ate very little meat. I was not interested in meat. I fell for this whole nonsense about, you know, meat is bad for your heart. Meat gives you cholesterol. You don't want to do that. And I even didn't like beef. So if you think about what they're doing to us, I physically did not like the smell or the taste of beef because they told me it's bad for me. Mm-hmm. And they told me I shouldn't eat it. And so somehow I believed that. And when I started this diet, I'm like, darn, man, I'm going to have a hard time. I started with bacon and I started with eggs. But I was desperate because I was basically eating fruits and vegetables and a little bit of meat. There was nothing more I could really cut out. I'm not an unhealthy eater.
Right.
But what I realized is my cousin had passed away, and for some reason I stopped buying vegetables. Not vegetables, but salads. I would have a whole salad each day, myself, just myself. I stopped having salad. That made me feel better, which was mm-hmm. very strange. Then I would have one or two apples in one sitting. My husband would be like, why do you have to have two apples? I'm like, I'm Polish. We like apples. Like that was my excuse.
I'm Polish. Because,
you know, there was a lot of apples in Poland, right? So, you know, even during the worst of times, there was lots of orchard where you could go pick apples. At the very least, that was one staple. Potatoes, apples, and vodka. That's always you can find vodka. That's staple, like especially if you want to get along. So everybody understands vodka. So that in itself made me, when I realized, when I actually came to this diet, when I finally had, like, I was running out of things to eat, I just thought, I'll jump for it, and I'll probably won't do it for more than 30 days. Because I'm like you, I would love my fruits and vegetables. And I was more of a vegetable person than a fruit person, but I loved my fruits and vegetables. It was just beyond. I was known as the rabbit in my circles because I always had to have salads. And it's true. But I will tell you, my body completely functions differently. Like, everything in my body has changed. I mean, my body is still my body, but I had fungal, so I had fungus on my skin, so I had eczema. I struggled with eczema. I struggled with so many health issues. And looking at me, you would think I'm completely, completely healthy. I'd go to the doctors because I had major arthritis in my hips, major arthritis in my shoulders. I'm just 50. I just turned 50 this year. My mother has less arthritis in her hands than I started having arthritis in my hands. And 30 days on the diet. 30 days on the diet, I no longer had arthritis in my hands.
Wow.
No fruit. No vegetables, no sugar,
yeah.
And not natural, not any kind. Yeah. And I didn't think I could do it because I've never been on a diet in my life, like never a diet that I could stick to. I thought they were asinine because, like, if you have to keep, like, a tally of how many calories or how do you even know how many calories are in an apple? I mean, it's not really – every apple is a different shape, different size, different flavor. How the heck are you going to tell me it's got 100 calories in each apple? That's not possible. I never understood. Like, there's so many things that I never understood. I always told my husband, I don't fit into this world. And the one thing that I'm finding camaraderie in the circles of people that you're talking to, that Alan reached out to, we were all oddballs. We all were normal, I think, more natural. I think we just somehow... some normal stuck to our DNA, and we just came out and we thought that we were still in, like, two decades ago, and not. It's not. It's like I don't know. I remember asking my teachers questions that my friends weren't asking, and I just thought they were just ridiculous things that we were learning in school. And well, I was not a smart, I was only there for the social aspect. I did what I had to do. I never really, like, I did homework because I had to do it because my parents would get mad and then, you know, la-da-da. There were immigrants and they wanted, you know, they came all this way to make a better life for myself. I better be going to school and I better be, because they didn't realize that I was getting indoctrinated. They thought my school was the same as,
well, of course. And, you know, and what they had done was they'd made a conscious decision to get you out of a socialist, almost communist country and bring you over to what they perceived was a free country. But there's just one thing really quickly. I want to go back to the diet because you made me think, you know, right after I had that episode with Matt, I had been having an email back and forth with someone, and he didn't explicitly say that he was vegetarian, but I got the sense that he was.
That he was.
And maybe possibly even vegan. I just got the sense of that. And he did not like that episode, and he was pointing out several things about it that he didn't like, and the killing an animal for starters, all of this, you know, that just wanted to talk about psychopathy, diet, et cetera, et cetera. And I said to him, I think he asked me why I didn't interview a vegan or a vegetarian. And I said the truth. I said, no vegetarian or vegan has ever approached me and said, I want to do, you know, like the counter. I want to talk about vegetarianism. And I said, and since this episode, no one has said I want to counter that. And I said, if you do, you know, please do. But I didn't hear from him again. I think in that email, I said to him that I was raised a vegetarian. And I'll tell you, this is true. I was taken to a slaughterhouse where they slaughtered they slaughtered beef at this place. You know, Texas is known for beef cattle and whatnot. I was taken there as a child as part of the indoctrination against eating meat. And they showed us right up. Yes. I mean, we didn't see the actual death of the cow, but we saw right up to the point where the cow is stunned. They're bringing them up a walkway and then down, and they stun them, and then they go and they gave us, as children, very, very graphic description of what happened.
Yes.
And I have to tell you,
in a very industrial kind of atmosphere,
yes,
correct?
Yes, absolutely. And, So that was that.
So you weren't taken to a farm. Yeah,
no.
You weren't taken to a farm where a farmer loved all of his cows and called them and they came. And you weren't shown that you have to respect this cow.
No, but to the point that this person was making, and I've heard other people make this point, is like, as a farmer, right? What kind of a psychopath do you have to be to name your cow or love your cow or your pig or your sheep or whatever and take such good care of it, and then you're going to slaughter it and eat it or sell it for, you know, wool or meat or, you know. And I said to him, I understand what you're saying, but I don't believe in utopia.
No. And also, food is something that looks different on every plate. And when I'm saying plate, I mean for every species, food looks different. For a cow, it's grass. For a lion, it's a gazelle.
Yeah.
Are you going to now make a lion a vegetarian? So how many gazelles are there going to be in the world?
Right. I mean, what I'm saying is that, yes, I can eat meat, and I can actually think about the animal that died, and I can have a feeling of conflict about that, but we're in what Alan described as the middle plane. And the middle plane, we have been in this illusion, but under the control of psychopaths for eons. And so nothing that we are given here in our, and so what I think what people are, is good, right? We're not given anything good.
Yes.
That's what I wanted to complete my thought
there. We're
given
all rubber mallets. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're given rubber mallets and we're given real nails, and now, and they're saying, here, go and build a house. And you're trying to build this house.
So what I think we're
trying.
People who think and we care and, you know, we want to wake the world up to what's going on. We, all of us, I think, who've come to Alan and listened to him, we're alarmed, and we want to do something or say something to make it different. But I just, maybe it's because of the way that I was raised by vegetarian parents. I went to California. Everybody was having high colonics all day long and eating green, you know, drinking wheatgrass. And, you know, I've been around enough people. And what I, my own observation is that these people are seeking some kind of kingdom of heaven from the food that they eat. And I'm just here to say it doesn't exist here. Might as well enjoy a steak.
And especially if it's going to make you satiated. Like, and that's the thing. The thing is, okay, so here's my working theory with this diet. This is what I said to my girlfriend, because my very best friend is a vegan. So you can imagine, when I went on this diet, I was only going to do it for 30 days because I thought it was extreme and ridiculous. But when I realized it could help with when I started realizing that autoimmune diseases potentially, because can't believe I don't believe anything I hear, but I don't discredit anything I hear either, which is kind of counterintuitive, I guess, but I mean, this is the rope that we're walking on. I didn't want to tell her because I didn't think I was going to stick to it, because I thought, this is probably just some nonsensical thing, and I'm going to try it because I tried everything else, and I can't pick up a frying pan because my hand is so bad with arthritis that I'm just going to try it. I did not want to give up any of the wonderful fruits and vegetables that I like. I had a garden last year. I'm planning to have another garden in the place that we talked last. But the thing is I didn't want to tell her because I didn't think I was going to sustain it. First of all, I've never done a diet where I can actually, not eat something. I always eat what I want, and I don't eat a lot of bad things, so I never really cared. But what I realized is, How do you capture a wolf? How do you get a wolf to trust you?
I don't know.
Right? Like, how do you... Okay, so this is my theory. My theory is, Alan is living in the woods and he falls in love with a beautiful wolf. He wants that wolf to be inside his house. Well, guess what? He's not coming inside the house. He's not stupid. He's not going to go into his human's house. So what do? You give him an offering of a nice chunk of meat on the end of the property. And he comes there for a month, and every day you give him a piece of meat. But you start incrementally, just like they do, you start incrementally bringing that meat closer to the door. And by this time, 6 months has passed, and the wolf trusts you because you've been giving him so much meat every single day. He's no longer hunting because now he's coming to you for the meat. And now you put his bowl on the inside of your house, and after a month of him going inside your house and eating, you close the door. And now the wolf doesn't know how to hunt, is completely dependent on him, and now you can put him on kibble. That's my theory.
I like that. I like the whole analogy there. I want to say quickly, too, that, like I said, I can't be rigid about anything. It's just not my personality. But I will say this. Having had this craving for fruit in the morning and a bowl of kimchi for lunch, I have more energy when I eat a lot of meat. And that is the bottom line for me. I'm less tired and more energetic when my diet is heavy in animal protein. Now,
I have to say that was true for me too.
Okay. We're running out of time, but there was a story that I wanted you to tell people, and before I ask you to tell that story, I wanted to say something that we didn't say straight up here when we got the background. You came to Alan's talks, like, say, 17 or 18 years ago, long time ago, and your cousin listened, and your brother listened, and your husband listened, but it was your mother who first discovered Alan. She's the one.
So no, it was my brother.
It was your brother, Alan. And then he got your mother on.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he got my mother to listen, and she said, "Yes, this guy's good." But my brother said to me, "Well, because we were listening to Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn, and sort of more of the less Alex Jones, because Alex Jones, even though he may have truths that he is dispensing, I just, you know what, I don't trust, and maybe this is not a good metric, but I don't trust anyone that is making the amount of money that he's making, giving the news that he's giving, and being touted everywhere, whether it's negative or positive feedback, it doesn't matter. He's out there and he's very big. So I didn't like, my brother listened to him for a little bit, and I just said to him, you know what, I can't listen to him because I'm a very hyper personality, as you have probably realized, and I'm very strong in my, you know, the way I like to, I need someone that isn't as, rah! He was just, you wanted to jump off a cliff after listening to that guy. We interrupt everybody.
I just wanted to set you up for this story by saying that listening to Alan, because I think this will be a good one for us to end up on, but listening to Alan, it was a family affair. Your brother discovered, brings it to your mother. And I would like you to tell people about the note that you got from Alan and what happened.
Oh,
next.
This my Alan departure, yes. So I would periodically, because I wasn't a regular person that donated money to him, I periodically would send him, you know, whatever. I would send him a donation because I'd already purchased his books for my mom, and I figured I'll read them. I know I'm cheap, but I'll read them and blah, blah, blah. But what happened was, I had a slight falling out with my family, as it were. At that time, I had fallen out, and I didn't have the book. So I asked my cousin. I was asked what I wanted for my birthday, and I said I wanted Alan's book. So she ordered Alan's book, and I said, okay, I'm going to write Alan a note because I'm going to send him a donation. So I sent him a donation, and it was like maybe, I would say, 3 months prior. And I never usually got anything back from Alan except when he wrote in my mom's book or when he, you know, when I ordered, he would write something. But I never really respond. I never got anything from him because I didn't want anything from him. I just wanted to send him to thank him, to let him know that someone is listening and that he's changing. He's changed out the course of my family's life 100%. And that's myself, my brother, my cousin, my father, and my mother. We all understand, and my husband too, now that he's come on board, but and he was the most resistant. Actually, the pork chop was the most resistant. but when I all of a sudden, I had already bought, because I listened to what he said, and he said, you know, this is going to be in cities, it's going to be a nightmare. So when COVID happened, I bought a place not too far from where you guys lived, I guess. And basically, I got a note from him. I mean, I got a letter. Actually, I got a letter. I touted it as a letter. And it just basically said, thank you for your donation, and something along the lines of, hold on, or take care of yourself in the hard times or the difficult times ahead, or something like that, to that effect. And it was only half a piece of paper lined, and it had, you could tell he tried to fold it and then tried to rip it, but the rip didn't work out. You know, sometimes you fold it and you didn't fold it. He didn't fold it well enough, and then it just kind of ripped. So I had this half page with, like, kind of torn off, and I read it, and I'm like, oh! I said to my cousin, because when I opened it, I was elated. I was running around my whole office, and my cousin's like, what are you doing? I go, I got a letter from Alan. I got a letter from Alan. I'm so excited. I'm such a girl when it comes to these kind of things. And she goes, Princess, because that's what she called me. Princess, that's a note. It's not a letter. I go, listen, this man is a very busy man. The fact that he took a piece of paper and pen and wrote anything for me to have is the fact that he took time for me. That's all that matters. So then 2 hours later, I was packing. I was getting ready to go up north to my property because we were just preparing things, water and all of those electricity. We were trying to put all that together. My cousin was on the phone. Someone had called her, and I was just getting ready to leave. We were just getting ready to depart. We were just putting things away, final things, and I was just coming to kind of say goodbye, and I'm like, what's the matter? Because at this point, my cousin already had cancer, and I thought maybe she was on the phone with a doctor, and I'm like, what's the matter? I saw her face. You know, when you know someone and something's going on and they haven't said anything yet, but you know something's really wrong. I said, Yasinna, what is the matter? Because I need to go. She looked at me and she said, it's your mom. And I said, okay. I thought something happened in my family. She said, your mom just called to let you know that Alan died. And I had, like, my balloon of energy after speaking with you last week. I was elated. I was a floating balloon. And then, literally in a minute, everything came out of me. And then I spent the whole weekend crying. The whole 6-hour drive up, I cried. Couldn't believe it. I listened to Neil Foster, because Neil Foster at that point had already, at that point I had listened to Neil Foster's whatever information I could find. The whole way up, I was trying to, and that was I had one moment of flight, and then like a Boeing 747, I literally fell out of the sky in 2 hours. I had 2 hours of elation that this man that has taken his life and given it all up for us, really, because that's what did he get besides the fact that he was trying to wake only a small portion of people up, because he knew very well he wouldn't be able to do everybody. But he was happy with the amount that he had, and the fact that I have a piece of paper that my cousin called a note from Alan, for me, that has way more weight than any money that I owe, that I own, I mean. Like, that's more than I can ever purchase and that is spirit, that's soul, that's there. Like, it's a piece of paper with nothing but a thank you note written on it, and it meant the world. It still means the world to me that I still got something that I can hang on to. It's such a human thing to hang on to these things, right? But that's what happened with Alan. And I always said, and that's why I reached out to you, because I regretted that I did not reach out to him like some of your listeners that were longtime listeners. For heaven's sakes, I think my whole family felt so unworthy, because that's not the word, but we felt so, like, we would be inconsiderate if we bothered him in his work. Do you know what I mean? Kind of. That's why I didn't want to bother him. That's why I bothered you now, because I regretted not bothering him. When I hear that he reached out to people, he talked to people, he helped that person, you know, that was on the verge. You helped that person that was on the verge because he had gone. That's what I felt. I felt I lost a family member that I'd never met. It was such a surreal moment, and that's why even when I was writing you that email, I was crying, because I was so elated that you answered me. So that's my story with Alan, and I am so grateful to God that my brother stumbled on him. I'm so grateful to God that I was able to understand what he said, to not everything yet, because I'm re-listening to everything. I'm re-listening to from the beginning. I have to say, I prefer when you and him are on. I don't like it when all the other talk show hosts are. There's such a stark difference between the way you guys speak and the way that other people speak. It's almost like a crow and a songbird. There's a huge difference. Like, a crow is annoying, and even though like, a crow has its purpose and function, and I know it needs to be a crow, and I'm not trying to pick on crows. I'm just saying, if you have to compare the listening to you and Alan, for me, it's like a songbird. Even though I know you guys are singing a really sad song, I rather look the beast in the eyeball, because I rather know how I'm going down. I don't want to be jumped on from the back. I just don't. Like, and most people just prefer to just get surprised. I was like, no thanks. Well, for like birthday surprises,
Monica, when when you told me that story, it made me cry, and I thought, okay, well, I'll have you share that today, and it won't make me cry because I heard it before, but it made me cry again.
It makes me cry almost every time. It's a loss for me as well as you, and for all of us. Because when I hear all the people that you do real histories with, we are a community. You know, You know where we are? We're the coronavirus community, together, apart. That's the only time where that makes sense. You know that girl? You know that girl thing? I feel like that actually applies to us because I feel so close to Alan, and I never met the man. And he meant so much. He had such a weight in my family's life, and I don't mean just mine. Mine, my husband's, my cousin who now has gone, has passed. She's been relieved. She's been relieved of her human duties, which I'm so pleased for her because she really suffered. But you know, she even helped my other cousin in Poland, who's still in Poland. None of her family is vaccinated. None of them.
Wow.
Or I don't know if we're allowed to say that word. So we feel like we've been able, Alan has saved many people because he didn't only save my family. My daughter got kicked out of university because she refused to take the jab.
Wow.
But I don't see that she sees the disconnect that she went back because she was able to go back after. And she doesn't still yet understand that what she's learned is also as sinister as the whole institution.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, this
you know,
is,
she understood yeah. when she, yeah. Anyway, so that's that. And I have to tell you, he was together, but apart from us. he's an essential person in our family unit, basically.
Well, I love hearing that. That is just a wonderful story. I think we're going to have to do another talk together for everyone because maybe later in the summer we can do that because you've made a move to go up to leave where you are in Southern Ontario and to go to Northern yes. Ontario, and it's a very cool story, and I think we can share that what you're up to. And
oh, that would be great.
Yeah. But I
love
thank
to
you.
Chat with you anytime you have time, because I know that you are a woman with a mission. And I am trying to get on that mission as well. I promise that once I fully move up and once I have a break and don't die of a heart attack because I suddenly stop working, I think I would love to participate and help where I can. If there's anything that you need help with that I am able to help with, I will. I'm also trying to do my thing to also spread his word without actually maybe necessarily saying exactly what he says, because he knew how to speak mm-hmm. without the brain on that man is, I just don't know how to wrap my brain around his brain because he was so young. Yeah, he was so young when he started this. I was so stupid when I was his age when he started. It's just when I think about, and I know that because I'm a woman, it's a little different. Because I do believe, like, I am a true believer. You know how Alan didn't want to tell you certain things because he said that women can't keep secrets?
Yeah.
Well, that's probably true. Yeah. And I do agree that we are so different, men and women. And I very much feel that if we don't realize that we all have gifts that we can add to this, I mean, we're going to be apart more. So if I can help in any area, you know, I'm at your disposal. If I can help spread this, if I can wake one more person up, that would be, I think that would show Alan that we really are here to also help move it along. Because I think what he did for all of us, he gave up his life for all of us, because that's how I see it. And maybe it's too extreme, but I'm a very obviously extreme personality. And also, I haven't heard a lot of women on coming here. Like, one thing that I find, that there isn't a lot of women in this community. And I think maybe why I got so much energy from you is you were another woman that I can talk to. I haven't really been a, every person I speak to that I'm able to speak to about politics, it's always a man.
I do think that that men just naturally seek out this kind of information, and women don't naturally. I think that's probably we're designed to, you know, this might offend a few women, but I think we're designed to be protected and buffered from some of the harsh realities
yeah.
by a man.
But what But what I'm hoping about now, being a woman, and we're talking about this, I'm hoping, because our conversations are going to be a little less, they're going to be more, maybe more girl friendly, women friendly. I don't know. See, I'm scared to say anything because I'm totally not politically correct, and that gets me into trouble. But, you know, for me, maybe being a woman, talking to a woman on one of these things, maybe other women will be inclined to do it. And maybe we can bring women into the fold. Maybe we can try to get them, even if we talk a little bit more about families and how families have been affected, because this starts at the woman level. The woman is left teaching the children. The woman is the neck. The man is the head. I've always believed that. The head. You can't do anything without the neck. You can't do anything without the neck. We are integral couples. Like the opposites is what makes us strong, not being, making us similar. If my husband can pick up the same amount that I can pick up, well, then who cares? Then we could do the whole job. But if I'm doing something completely different and I'm feeding you while you're picking up the heavy stuff, well, that works for me because I didn't want to pick that up anyway.
That's right.
I don't know why women want to be so, yeah, like why they want to be. You are not Alan. You were a compliment to Alan. And the reason why you were so complimentary is you weren't the same. And that's why you guys made such an amazing, amazing duo. You're welcome to use me for Alan's work and this work, this very important work, whenever you need me. So I am at your disposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Monica. And for everyone listening, next week is going to be another Canadian, Robert. Yes, and he is from Alberta. So we get a different province. But a Canadian, and that's the way it lines up. So thank you all for listening, and I'll be back next week with Robert.
Well, I've got something that the world needs.